So His Holiness is now reading from the text. So mainly, Nagarjuna's commentary to Bodhicitta and Bodhisattvacharya's explanation on the shortcomings of selfishness and the benefits of cherishing others. And then one have to think on the... If you just think from the point of one's own welfare, then one feels like it's enough if I can attain liberation. But for all sentient beings, we must attain the state of Buddhahood. So the self-cherishing mind, as long as that mind is there in our mind, in our continuum, it will be an obstacle to our practice of cherishing others as more important. So this is my opinion. So without bodhicitta, whether one practices Kuya Samaja or Heruka or Yamantaka, if we act as servants to self-cherishing mind, then there's no way one can attain Buddhahood. Also, if one when one recites the sadhanas, we say instantly I transform into Yamantaka or this and that deity. As long as the self-cherishing mind is strongly there, it's just pointless. So that's why I think out of the three lineages, the blessing lineage is actually something that pertains to the tantric teaching. As I generally say, there's a division, the general public teaching and individual teaching. The treatises composed by Asanga and the treatises by Nagarjuna are the general commentaries on the Buddha's teaching, whereas the tantric teachings are what we call kansa guese, means individually prescribed teachings. So, for example, such practices like drops, channels, and wind varies from different lineage to different lineage. That's because these teachings are individually prescribed teachings. They are not like public, sort of like a blanket teaching for everybody. So this we must, this is a very important division or differentiation that we should be, distinction we should be able to make, no, we should understand. So otherwise, the meaning of the Tyata Gadigata Paragata Parasangvati Buddha, the mantra of Prajna Paramita, its explanations are given only in the treatises of Nagarjuna Asanga. And also Nagarjuna's verses in his Madhyamaka Molakariga on saying no self, not from oneself, not from others, etc. These are all practice. these are practices for the like sort of the foundation. So Nagarjuna and his treatises are really the real lamp of the three worlds. So if we study those treatises of Nagarjuna, then so if we go into Tantra, even scholars, intellectuals, it's difficult in Tantra as far as Tantra is concerned. But as far as Madhyamika view is concerned, when the concept of dependent arising, whoever, no matter what a person's background is, all scholars, intellectuals will appreciate and admire this. That's why today, the reason why scientists and scholars admire Buddhism is because of this very reason. Because the concept of lack of inherent existence is something now the scientists themselves are also explaining. The concept of quantum physics is a scientific finding. The scientists themselves, according from the quantum scientists, is saying that there's nothing inherent in the universe. And this is exactly what the Madhyamika philosophy asserts. So at the moment, quantum physics confines its research mainly to the material objects, not on mind and mental states. My friend, the late Raja Ramanai, the Indian scientist, during a meeting in Delhi, he was there and he told me that quantum physics is a new phenomena, new scientific phenomena in today's world. It's a new finding. But this knowledge has been existing in India since 2,000 years ago, and it was there in Nagarjuna's works, treatises. Because he saw a work by Nagarjuna and he found quantum physics right there. So this is really true, and so this is what it means by moving at inspiring scientists, scholars, great minds. It cannot move villagers or people, uneducated people, but it will inspire and fascinate the great minds. In Praise to Emptiness by Nagarjuna, Nagarjuna has said that emptiness has no inherent nature. The general explanation of the four fundamentals like without as impermanent suffering, empty and bliss. That is a general explanation. But the real meaning of emptiness is explained in Nagarjuna's works. As I usually always say, having seen the real meaning, which is a quotation from Lama Tsongkhapa's Praise to Emptiness, a praise to the Buddha through dependent arising. So in that verse, the quotation, Tsongkhapa says that he feels great faith and inspiration, appreciation for the Buddha from the bottom of his heart and from the bone marrow because of this teaching on dependent arising and emptiness. And this, I think, is really a great seal I also tell that a great master, somebody called Miyang something, I think from a Nyingma tradition, his owner said that he's a disciple of Zabadru. He studied many of Tsongkhapa's treatises, and he has a commentary on Minya. This master's name is Minya Kunsu, and Kun Lama Rinpoche told me that this lama's commentary on Chenju Bodhisattva Charya is an excellent commentary, and also Jum Mipham, in some of his works, he has critiques against Tsongkhapa on Tsongkhapa, some of Tsongkhapa's explanation on emptiness. Incarnation of Demoloche Rinpoche and Parirapsi's critique, refutation of Minya Jum Mipham, both didn't sort of were not very successful to refute Jum Mipham. And Khun Lam Rinpoche said that, but the work, the critique by sort of the real answer to Jum Mipham's critique of Tsongkhapa was actually given by this master, Minya Kunsu, in which Minya Kunsu defended Tsongkhapa. And that refutation, answered Jum Mipham's critique, a refutation of Tsongkhapa. That is said by Khun Lama Rinpoche to me. So I saw that text by Minya Kunsu, and it was really excellent. And it is said that Rendawa Shunu Lodu specialized on emptiness. And from that time onwards, there's a sort of a saying or sort of a tradition hype spread, which says, if you meditate on emptiness. Like Tsongkhapa's work, like treatises like Uma Gongpa Rabse and commentary to Chandrakirti's Madhyamika Avatara, and praise to Tak Dungwu, these are composed by Tsongkhapa in his later part of his life. So me too. Every time I open my mouth, it is sort of more or less I'm talking about emptiness. That is because I am compelled to do so, because without emptiness, without the practice of emptiness, nothing else works. Because the only real practice that can overcome the self-grasping mind, the self-cherishing mind, is emptiness. We can overcome self-cherishing mind and self-grasping mind through the understanding of emptiness, then the parts, the graduated parts, like part of accumulation, part of preparation, part of seeing, etc., automatically starts starts realizing. Bodhicitta is an unsurpassable path, but without emptiness, what can bodhicitta do? A practitioner cannot even move beyond the path of preparation without emptiness. So therefore, the students, monk students here, who the emptiness view is extremely important. So we have to, you must study the Madhyamika Mulakarika by Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti's commentary on Madhyamika Mulakarika 6L is matchless, and Bhava Vikas, so also Buddha Palita's commentary. So so Tsongkhapa's commentary to Madhyamika Mulakarika, called Sashi Tikshi Rigpe Gyatso, the ocean of knowledge, that is the sort of the overall commentary to all of these earlier works. So this is something very important. So even during Randhava's time, there was this saying I already mentioned to you before, and me too. I'm not saying the experience of emptiness is very difficult, but I don't deny that I do have some experience. So through the emptiness understanding, through this understanding, we can understand that a cessation of suffering is a possibility. Because all afflicted emotions finally sort of trace back to originates from self-grasping mind. And then this self-grasping mind boils down to our misunderstanding of the nature of phenomena, and that can be overcome only by understanding the true reality of phenomena. So when we understand this point, then we can see that truth of cessation is a possibility. So this is also the understanding of the Dharma, the out of the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So the meaning of Dharma can be understood through this way. So if we don't, it's not enough to just learn the verbal meaning of the text, the division, subdivisions, the definitions, and what debates are there here and there. As long as we don't try to look inside and try to practice and try to overcome and fight self-grasping mind, then through the understanding of emptiness, nothing can change. So I think His Holiness is reading. I will just try to read through. I don't think I will be able to catch up with His Holiness, but I will just read some passages. With these thoughts, you will come to feel, may these sentient beings have every form of happiness, which is the development of love. In the profession of wisdom's wisdom, it is said that there is no end. There's no end. There's a debate on whether there is end to samsara or not. So I have some difficulty with this debate. All the same, let me read from here. All the same, can we achieve this Buddhahood? We can, and the best physical rebirth to have for its attainment is the optimum rebirth. We have gained a very special type of physical rebirth. We were born from the womb of a human of the southern continent, and we have the six types of physical constituents. All we need to do is make use of this opportunity to achieve the state of Vajradhara in one lifetime. Still, are you now able to do this? As for right now, forget all beings. You cannot work for the sake of even one sentient being. Who then can? The Bodhisattvas abiding on the pure levels and the Shravakas or Pratyek Buddhas can benefit sentient beings, but they can only do a little of what the Buddhas are capable of doing. Thus, a Buddha who is without equal in his deeds for the welfare of sentient beings is the only one. Each ray of light from the Buddha body of a Buddha is able to mature and liberate immeasurable sentient beings. Buddhas emanate bodies that appear before each sentient being. These forms are tailored to the mental disposition, sense faculties, wishes, and karmic tendencies of these beings. Buddhas can teach them the Dharma in their individual languages. These are some of the capabilities of Buddhas. If you wonder whether we can achieve the level of Buddhahood, the answer is we can. The best of all physical rebirths to have for this attainment is the optimum rebirth. We have gained a very special type of physical rebirth. We are born from the womb of a human of the southern continent, and we have the six types of physical constituents. We are thus able to achieve in one life the state of unification of Vajradhara. Unless we do not apply ourselves, we have attained such a physical rebirth that the means to achieve Buddhahood is the Dharma of Supreme Vehicle and the teaching of the Victoria's Juan Tsongkhapa on this vehicle are completely unmistaken. His stainless teaching combined both the sutras and tantras we have met with such teachings. In short, we are free from any unfavorable conditions except for cheating ourselves by not making effort. If now, when we have attained such an excellent foundation with all the favorable conditions, we cannot achieve Buddhahood, it is certain that in the future we will not gain any better rebirth or dharma. Some of us might claim, now is a degenerate time, our timing has been bad. But since beginningless cycle existence, we have never experienced a time with more potential benefit for us than now. We could have no better a time than this. We shall find such a situation only once. We must therefore work toward our Buddhahood, come what may. Thus, this should lead you to feel, I shall do all I can to achieve my goal, peerless full enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. This thought, someone's Buddhist. Here, His Holiness says that Tantra may be greatly powerful, but if we use Tantra to achieve temporary goals like wealth, power, etc., for this world's gain, then it's a total waste of tantric path and tantric practices. And this is really true. I shall listen attentively to the Lamjim and then put it into practice. In general, it is vital to have one of these three motives at the beginning of any practice, especially when you listen to a discourse on the Lamjim. Just any motive is not sufficient. You must at least listen in conjunction with the force or contrived form of bodhicitta. For people who have already experienced the development of bodhicitta, it may be sufficient for them to think over a short formula such as, for the sake of all mother sentient beings. However, this is not enough to transform the mind of a beginner. If you think over the Lamrim, starting with the immense difficulty of gaining an optimal human rebirth, your mind will turn towards bodhicitta. This does not apply only to the Lamrim. When we Gelugpas attend any teaching at all, be it an initiation, oral transmission, discourse, or whatever, we should go over the whole Lamrim as a preliminary when we set our motivation. This one is just sort of saying something over one of the word. It's better to say it in this way or that way. This does not apply only to the Lamrim. When we Gelugpas attend any teaching at all, be it an initiation or a transmission discourse or whatever, we should go over the whole Lamrim as a preliminary. When we set our motivation, even short prayers include all of the three scopes of the Lamrim with nothing left out. My precious Guru has said time and again that this is the supreme distinguishing feature of the teachings of the Lord Kadamba, of the old Kadambas and of us new Kadambas. Those of you who will bear the responsibility of preserving these teachings must carry out your studies in this fashion. However, when giving a long life initiation, it is the practice not to speak about impermanence, and death and so on, as this is an inauspicious gesture. One only speaks on the difficulty of obtaining this optimum human rebirth. Some of the people attending this teaching of the Dharma might feel, I'm truly fortunate to be studying this, but I cannot put it into practice. Others attend because they are imitating others. If you go, I will come too. No one will attend this teaching in order to make a living out of performing rituals in people's homes, but this happens with other teachings like major initiation. When you attend other teachings, initiations for example, you may think you will receive the power to subdue evil spirits by reciting the mantra and so forth, and you may think you will subdue sickness or spirits, achieve wealth, acquire power, etc. Others, no matter how many teachings they have received, treat Dharma as if it were, for example, capital to start a business. They then go to places like Mongolia to peddle the Dharma. Such people accumulate enormous grave sins through the Dharma. The Buddha, our teacher, discussed the means to achieve liberation and omniscience. To exploit such teachings for worldly ends is equal to forcing a king off his throne and making him sweep the floor. So, if you seem to have any of these above mentioned bad motives, get rid of them, summon up summon up some contrived bodhicitta and then listen. So much for the setting of your motivation. Here follows the main body of the teaching to which you are actually going to listen. First, the Dhamma you are going to be going to practice should have been spoken by the Buddha and discussed and proven by the Indian Pandits. Your practice must be one from which the great adepts derive their insight and realization. Otherwise, an instruction could be termed profound, even if it were not something spoken by the Buddha and were unknown to the other scholar adepts. Meditate on such an instruction, and you could be in danger of getting some result that no one else has ever achieved before, not even the Buddhas. You therefore must examine the Dharma you are going to make your practice. As the Master Sakyapandita says, with the pettiest business deal in horses, jewels, and so on, you question everything and examine all. I have seen how diligent you are with the petty actions of this life. The good or bad in all your future lives comes from the holy Dharma. Yet you treat the Dharma like a dog eats food. You worship whatever comes along without first checking whether it is good or evil. When we buy a horse, for example, we examine numerous things, get a divination beforehand, and question lots of other people. Take the example of an ordinary monk. Even when he buys a tea brick, he checks its color, weight, and shape many times over. He makes quite sure it has not been damaged by water, etc. And he asks other people's opinions. Yet, if he is unlucky, it would only affect a few cups of tea. You investigate such things as this thoroughly, even though they have only temporary value for you, but you do not seem to investigate at all the Dharma you are to practice. Although this is the foundation of your eternal hopes for all your rebirths, you treat it like dogs does food. Whatever you chance upon is unacceptable. How very wrong that is. If you go wrong here, you have ruined your eternal hopes. Thus, you must examine the Dharma you intend to practice before you engage in it. I've already said since last year that Sripadala Lama's Lamrim, Jambe Shelong, is composed in such a way that it's sort of like the essence of Tsongkhapa's Lamrim Chemo. Benjen Losan Chuyin's Lamrim is sort of slightly a short version. And Lamrim Nyulam is excellent, but doesn't have the sort of that scholarly touch to that. Whereas Changzhu Shul, Fifth Dalai Lama's Lamrim has that. It contains the essence of Tsongkhapa's Lamrim, but it has a scholarly touch to it. So those teachings which have instruction lineage, we can say shit. They are instruction. They have shitty. And Yongzhi Yishi Genzin's commentary on the 800 verses sutra. Also has a shitty sort of this. It's very highly emphasized in the Lamrim Chemo by Tsongkhapa that there's a tendency that there are two kinds of dharma. One which is sort of like just for knowledge, and one for practice. And that is very wrong. Like, for example, Nagarjuna's treatises are like considered like for studied for knowledge. And that is Tsongkhapa sort of highly emphasized that this is a very wrong tendency. And because Nagarjuna, there's no such differentiation our usual sort of many of us sort of have that this tendency to think that when it said when you said menga or the instruction, we think it, we consider it like great, like a great treasure, a very secret, hidden. Whereas when you say like the five scriptures, five sciences, they are like treated like sort of just for knowledge. So Tsongkhapa says that there's no such thing as a separate menga instruction apart from the five sciences of Buddhist knowledge. So therefore, when from the in the three monasteries, from the very beginning, when teachers teach the basic logic to students, from the beginning, it is important for the teachers to teach in such a way that they teach that even basic logic. Not only they should teach just the word, the definition, the textual, the literature, but also try to explain, convey the meaning which is meant to be used for overcoming practice, overcoming our delusion and subduing our mind. So if we just keep on studying Dharma and leave our mind totally untrained, that's a disgrace. So whatever we learn should be utilized, implemented to as a tool to train our mind to practice. This is very important. All the teachers are here, and so this is something we should keep in mind. So generally, when we hear talk about the expansive view, contact lineage and profound view lineage, we treat them like sort of for something you study for knowledge, and then we when we think of instruction, the practice, we sort of have this tendency to think there's some other practice teaching apart from that. That's totally misunderstanding and wrong. So these are really the real instruction for practice. Whereas at the same time, what is called as the practice of blessing lineage, that is slightly different. That is, as I explained earlier, there are two kinds of things, public, general public teaching and individual individually prescribed teaching. So this thing called practice blessing lineage, that's something to do with sort of individual practice. Now it's time for tea. Now, just relish the tea. The chanting master, if he wants to, sing a very good sort of magnificent grace. Then first, just take a sip of tea and make your throat moist, and then say the grace, and the voice will be magnificent. A friend of mine who used to live somewhere nearby the border of Nepal, a great practitioner, he when he teaches his students, he just teach one section at a time, and then let the students go off and let them practice until the time the students have sort of developed certain kind of experience, and then come back. Go back to him, and then he teach them the next one. This is called experiential instruction. Regarding, as for example, Milarepa, he was practicing in the caves by himself, and then at times when he had particular difficulty with a certain point or some practice, then he visits his master and then asks for clarification or some help, and then the Lama teaches him helped him clarify that point, and then he goes back into his cave. So this is called experiential instruction. So Pavankar is saying here also he's going to teach this Lamrim in the experiential instruction format. So text says, the teaching I shall now offer is a practical discourse. A few of those present are unfortunate enough only to have the time to attend this sort of teaching once or twice. They are interested in these teachings, although they must later go their separate ways. For their sakes, I shall be combining the swift path and the brief and the detailed lineages of Manjushri's own words. Later on, when we get to that part, I shall give the 7-point mind training on the interchange of self and others. I have no reservations about giving this teaching. It will create root merits for the two departed aristocrats in whose memory this teaching is being given. The three beings, the format of the Lamrim, which is based on the three beings, is sort of based on this particular verse by
Sonam Mobo Tambu Dos in the Sirish.
Shigyapa. Shigyapa. Shigyapa.
It's based on a verse from the 400 verses by Arya Deva. So this verse, and the term the three beings is actually found in Asanga's treatises. And so the three beings is based on the fact that the first being and the practice of the first being emphasize on engaging in virtuous actions, virtuous actions, and avoiding, refraining from non-virtuous actions. Whereas the second being, the intermediate being, emphasizes on overcoming self-grasping mind by meditating on emptiness and subduing the afflictive emotions. And the third being emphasizes on the great path, the six perfections, to attain the state of Buddhahood. So this is a three-step way of training and leading a disciple from an ordinary state up to the state of Buddhahood. So there's not much difference between the Sakyapa's way of treating, teaching Lamrim and Nyingmapa's Longchen Pa's Simnyi Nyeso and Kagyupa's Thapo Tharkyen, the liberation, ornament of liberation by Thapowa. So in a sense, this the way of teaching this Lamrim sort of more or less same, and the format is same, and they are all based on Atisha's Lamb of the Path text, the original text of Lamrim composed by Atisha. So the text here, so the text reads, this teaching is the, here the Pavongkha is referring to his teacher, Jambe Rinpoche, Thakpo Jambe Rinpoche, a great master. So he says, my teacher. That's what he's Jambe Rinpoche is what he's referring to. So now the text says, now my teacher's own practical method consists of a series of topics that are based primarily on the swift path. The scholars, and this is how I shall present this, present these to the assembly. So Atisha is generally a disciple of Nalanja masters, like, but he was, he's actually mainly a master from Vikramalaya University, not really Nalanda. But according to one saying, he did went to Nalanda also at one time and studied there for a short time. And according to his way of teaching, Adisha's way of teaching, according to Vikramalaya's tradition, it's important. They emphasize on teaching the Lamrim through the three format. So mainly emphasize on first showing that the Sheje Chue Thakpa means the teaching that is going to be taught is a pure lineage, and which is based on sort of unbiased analysis. So according to this teaching, according to this lineage, the ultimate way of proving the authenticity of the Buddha's teaching is through logic and reasoning. In China, as I said before, okay. So, in the Chinese tradition, they follow the Samdhi Nirmochana Sutra, which is actually a sutra expounding on the Yogacara school of thought. So their way of sort of explaining the sutras is they just sort of rely on one sutra only and then try to interpret the Buddha's thought. So where Tsongkhapa says that it's not enough to, one should not just rely on one viewpoint, one sutra, and then try to say, okay, like it's like picking up one piece of grain and then say, all grains are like this. That's a totally wrong sort of approach. Tsongkhapa's approach is that he looks at, you know, sort of diverse teachings, sutras, and approaches, and the Brahmal. So Brahmal, just as we say, we depend on the four ways. So for here he's on his. The Nalanda tradition and the Brahmala tradition have a different version of different way of teaching Lambrim, or rather, whereas the this so in the Adisha's tradition, which is based on the Brahmala tradition, that first it depends on showing the quality of the Buddha, the teacher, next the Dharma, and like that. Whereas according to the Nalanda tradition, first the quality of the teaching is explained, and then the teacher, like that. So so here the text says, the scholars of Nalanda monastery used to say that it was important to teach the three purities before giving a teaching: the purity of the master's oral teaching, the purity of the mind stream of the disciple, and the purity of the Dharma being presented. The scholars of Brahmala Shila, in their introduction, used to discuss the greatness of the author, the greatness of the Dharma, and the way to explain and listen to that teaching. I shall follow this later tradition. So, His Honor said here, Adisha follows the Brahmala Shila tradition as he's from Brahmala Shila. The discourse on the stages of the path to enlightenment has four major parts: the greatness of the authors, given in order to show that the teaching has an immaculate source; number two, the greatness of the Dharma, given to increase one's faith in the instruction; three, the right way to teach and listen to this Dharma with these two greatnesses; four, the sequence in which the disciples are to be taught the actual instructions. These four teachings are found in Tsongkhapa's great stages of the path. No matter which Lamrim is being presented, the easy path and the swift path and so on, and no matter how much detail it is being given in, the oral tradition says you must start with these headings, without otherwise people will not develop enough conviction. The greatness of, the title of the next session is The Greatness of the Authors, given to show the teaching has an immaculate source. So first, this text is going to this Lamrim called Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand will explain the quality of the author, which is the Buddha. As I said, the Adisha Dipamkara Shirigyanas is the source of the Lamrim tradition. So Adisha's life story will be explained in brief in this text. Adisha's birthplace is in present-day Bangladesh. So the text reads, as I said yesterday, according to the tradition of Indian scholars, Dharma you are to practice must be one taught by the Buddha, proven by the pundits, and utilized in the meditation of great and powerful adepts to produce realizations and insights in the mind streams. It says that His Honor says that in the text, it says that Adisha's family are royals, they're kings, and they that in the Lamrim, there's a it says that Adisha's father and who was a royal king, and their sort of power and greatness was as great as the Chinese Tonghun royal family. And Chanke Rinpoche has said that this is because Tibetan masters don't know the Chinese language. Tonghun just basically means east. Tong means east. It doesn't mean that the word Tonghun doesn't mean show that the king is great or something like that. So His Honor said this is just trivial. It's nothing, not that important. The text reads, on our part, to trace a river back to its sources, you need to go right back to the snow line. So too must you trace the Dharma back to the Buddha, our teacher. If I had, by the time I knew enough to discuss this in detail, I would take the Buddha as my starting point and give the biographies of all the lineage gurus, telling how they made use of this very path to attain their highest status. But I do not have enough time for such an extraordinary lengthy discussion. I shall only tell you a little of this. Next section is Pavongka. The title of the next section is Pavongka Dorje Chang. Then told us a little of how they came to be two lineages from the Buddha down to Adisha, and how Adisha combined the two into one stream. He continued. Okay, the text starts. Adisha rode the lamb on the path to enlightenment in Tibet. The term Lamrim came later. The root text for the subject matter in all teachings, such as the Lamrim, the Supreme Path, the Great Teachings, and so on, in his masterpiece, The Lamb on the Path. Thus, Adisha becomes the virtual author of them all. Even Great Jetsongkhapa wrote, the author of this is really Adisha, so I really ought to give you a detailed life's history of Adisha, but I have time only for a short version. This has three headings. One, how he was born to one of the highest families. Two, how he attained his good qualities in that very rebirth. Three, the things he did to further the doctrine after gaining these qualities. Next section, the title is How Adisha Was Born to One of the Highest Families. Text continues. Adisha was born in the celebrated land of Eastern India known as Bengal, in a large city in and around which there were 100,000 households, and he had 35,000 servants. His father's palace was called the Palace of Golden Victory Banners. The word tuku was not there in India, but even in India, there used to be this notion that some so and so, such and such person was sort of a reincarnation of a previous master. This was there even in the Hindu tradition, but in Tibetan tradition, the word tuku came. So tuku and lama sort of became interchangeable, and it was first started by Gamabo Tsumkhen, but he made a very clear prophecy of his next reincarnation, and then the next Gamabo was born, recognized on the basis of that prophecy. So, and then since then, this tradition started. And following that, many other masters also had similar powers, and more tukus came. But then slowly, gradually, we had too many of them. But then it is one high lama said that it's great that we have so many lamas and tukus, but when we see that some lamas and some reincarnation tukus acts, you know, disgracingly, then it's very disappointing and sad. So now, regarding Dalai Lama, Dalai Lama's reincarnation, the present Chinese government seems to be more concerned about his reincarnation than myself. I have said since 1960s that whether the Dalai Lama office is needed or not will be decided by the Tibetan, determined by the Tibetan people. If they think there's need for it, they will preserve it. If they think it's not needed anymore, they will not preserve it. So in the recent times, some people are now just talking about raising this issue, and I jokingly tell them that I am the 14th Dalai Lama. The 14th Dalai Lama is someone loved by many people. So has a good reputation. So it's better to conclude the Dalai Lama lineage when it is loved and respected. It's not good if another Dalai Lama comes and does disgraceful things and spoils the name of the Dalai Lama, then it will be a very unfortunate thing. Just recently in Rome, some people asked me about this. I said that the Chinese government, before taking concern about Dalai Lama's reincarnation, first they should find the reincarnation of Deng Xiaoping and then Mao Zedong. And then it would be befitting to be concerned about Dalai Lama's reincarnation. Otherwise, it's very awkward or very strange for a regime who doesn't believe in religion, life after death, to be concerned about reincarnation of Dalai Lama. For example, many Chinese emperors were Tibetan Buddhist, and received teachings from Tibetan master like Zhangjie Rinpoche, Thukien Chögyam Nyima, the third Dalai Lama, Sonam Gyatso, like that. So this is just a conversation on the site. So it is important for spiritual masters to be Kejun Sangsum, scholar, practitioner, and good-natured. So that was what Atisha was like. So not only lamas, even all Tibetan people, men and women, I emphasize, should be like that, intelligent, learned, good-natured, and moral people. If we can be like that, so this is not we should understand that it is not saying those who are virtuous should be like that so that the rest of the people can praise them. But this is rather everyone should try to be like that. That is, you can just simply say be learned, moral, and good-natured. In Kedu Rinpoche's, in one of his compositions, he has said that pure view means Gelugpa's doesn't mean Gelugpa should not when teaching like let's say uh, pure view doesn't. So here his holiness is talking about what is pure view and what is mixing views of different schools. So which is regarded as an incorrect something which should not be done. What that means is when Kiddur Rinpoche is, for example, what that means is when you are teaching Gelugpa view, one should not use that while you are allowed to teach Sakya view and Nyingma view. There's no harm in that, but you should not mix the terms. The terms have their own unique meanings, and so each one term should not be used to explain the meaning of or the views of four schools. So that's the meaning of keeping the pure view pure. For example, how to keep the Gelugpa view pure. For example, Fifth Dalai Lama, for example, Pawonka, as far as Pawonka is concerned, Tejan Rinpoche himself told me that when he was small, Pawonka was at one time staying at the Chupsang Hermitage, and he was doing a retreat of Dandi Yangsang. And he saw Pawonka making small pills, red pills. And Pawonka told Tejan Rinpoche, this is a pill to do some ritual of the Damding Yangsang, which is a Nyingmapa practice deity. And later on, Pawonga even considered receiving the teaching of Dezhu Pupsang, which is a Nyingma tradition. But then following that, he had some kind of interaction with the Shukden deity, and then he couldn't go ahead with that. So in his upper part of his life, he was sort of non-sectarian practice, and His Holiness 13th Dalai Lama was very, very kind to him. But in his second half of his life, his viewpoint changed, and he practiced non-sectarianism, and 13th Dalai Lama became very distant from him, like that. So here, when it says that the text is Pawonka is saying, it is very important that Gelugpa view is preserved in a pure form. So pure form, we should know, doesn't mean you are not allowed to learn the views of other schools, and or even teach them. But rather, it means the terminology had their unique meanings, and one should not use the Gelugpa terminology to explain the view of Dzogchen, and Dzogchen terminologies to explain the view of the Gelugpa or Sakya or like that. So that's the point. Now the text is talking about how Adisha felt like renouncing the world and practicing Dharma. Let us, according to Adisha's biography, it looks like Adisha was a vegetarian and he didn't take non-veg food. So And I think here we are here. Okay, here. He met Avadhutipa, who told him, "Go back to your father's kingdom today. Look into the drawbacks of a layman's way of life." And so he returned home, much to the delight of his parents. "Where have you been, Chandragarbha?" they asked. "Are you weary? Are you sad? How good it is you have returned," he replied. "I've been in search of a guru, the sage's place of refuge. I've been to mountain caves and empty places in the search. No matter where I went, I saw the drawbacks of samsara. Whoever I befriended told me of the drawbacks of samsara. No matter what I do, dissatisfied I am, set me free and I shall return to the Dharma." His parents told him that if samsara made him so unhappy, he should take up his royal duties. Then he should make offerings to the three jewels, make donations to the poor, build temples, invite sangha, and so on. Then he would be completely happy. Adisha said, "I've seen much of samsara," he replied. "I am not even minutely attached to the trappings of a royal life. A golden palace is no different from a prison. Queens are no different from the daughters of Mara. The three sweet substances are no different from dark meat, pus, and blood. There is not the slightest difference between the beauty of wearing silks and jewels and donning a filthy blanket in a cemetery. I shall go into the forest to meditate. Today, give me a little mead, milk, honey, and sugar cane. I will go to Venerable Avadhuti." This was the gist of the song sung to his parents. His mother and father gave him permission to do so as he wished, and he set out for the forest with 1,000 horsemen. He became a follower of Avadhutipa, who initiated him into the development of Bodhicitta. "Go to the temple of Krishnagiri, the Black Mountain," said Avadhutipa, "where Sri Rahula Gupta lives. He too was once your guru." Guru Rahula happened to be giving a tantric teaching when he saw the prince coming, and although he knew that Isha had come in quest of Dharma, he hurled a bolt of lightning at the prince to test him. Then Rahula went to the top of the mountain where there was a black Trithika stupa. His retinue yogis asked the guru who this person was. Rahula replied, "For 552 rebirths, he has been nothing but scholarly pundits. At present, he is heir to the Bengali Dharma king, Kalyana Shiri. He is unattached to the royal life and wishes to take up ascetic practices." Everyone was astonished. They stood up and welcomed him. As soon as he saw the guru, Adisha said, "Holy guru, hear me. I have left my home and wish to achieve liberation, but you have been born to a famous royalty, a famous family, am in danger of being bound to Bengal. I have devoted myself to Jitari, Bodhibhadra, Vidya Kokila, and Avadhutipa. Gurus have psychic powers, yet even now I am not free of my royal obligations. I have now been sent to you, O Guru. Initiate me into the Mahayana and the development of Bodhicitta. May I be free of these bonds." The guru responded by happily giving the initiation of Hey Vajra and all the instructions to the prince. Alone for 13 days, he was given the secret name Janana Guha Vajra. Rahula then addressed 88 terrifying and naked yogis and yoginis. "Follow him back to Bengal. Change the mind of the king, his father. When he's released from royal duties, take him back to his guru and Avadhutipa." The prince now dressed himself as Heruka, and when he approached the palace grounds, everyone's who saw him recognized him and became afraid. He wandered aimlessly for 3 months, behaving like a madman. The yogis and yogins ran and jumped about. Everyone saw that he was suddenly abandoned his kingdom, and they could not hold back their tears. His father was the most affected one and said, "Alas, my son, at your most excellent birth, I saw wondrous signs and thought you would pursue your royal duties. My faculties revive with this happy thought. What then has your forest retreat done to your mind?" The prince replied, "What say you, if I pursued duties royal, I could, father, be with you for this momentary life. But father wouldn't know the sun in all rebirths to come. How very wrong, where no benefits to be had. If I forgo the great demands of royal life and practice the sure path to liberation and enlightenment, we shall be together happily in all future lives. Therefore, grant me this opportunity." His mother said, What's the use when this child is so determined? Karma is the foremost thing that throws us to all rebirths. Oh, Holy One, practice Dharma you think best. Make prayers that we will be together always in my future lives. And she gave him permission. The prince yogis and yoginis leapt at first light for the forest hermitage of Guru Avadhutipa. School of thought text Chedashizuchamu. It was not in Tibetan, it was there in Chinese version, and I got one version, Chinese version, when I was in Tibet, and it was translated by Tongbu Rinpoche, and then after I the translation was sort of many of the chapters were translated, and then after I came to India, I sort of put them together, and one chapter was missing. And now, recently, one Geshe-la living in Taiwan completed that remaining chapter, and now it's all in Tibetan. And she gave him permission. The prince yogis and yoginis left at first light for the forest hermitage of Guru Avadhutipa, where he studied the Dharma of the Madhyamaka school. Adishe was taught the subtleties of the law of cause and effect, and from the age of 21 to 29, emulated Avadhutipa. In short, he contemplated and meditated on everything he studied, the Blue Book of Spells says. He followed Avadhutipa for seven years. Adishe could have been a king whose splendor would have equaled Chinese Emperor Li Shimin. 100,000 households were tenants of the king's palace with its victory banners, 25,000 bathing pools, 720 pleasure groves, and 56,000 palm trees. He could have had 3,500,000 subjects. The palace was surrounded by seven walls interconnected by 363 bridges. It had 25,000 golden victory banners, and the central palace had 13 pagodas. But great Adishe gave himself out of Dharma and rid himself of these unmatched trappings of princely power as one spits on the dust. Our teacher, the Buddha, did the same. Although he held the power of a universal emperor in the palm of his hand, he forsook it to become ordained. Thus, you must avidly read their biographies. If someone were now to say, give up your vows and you'll be appointed governor of a district, we would do it without hesitation. That just shows the extent of our resolve. It is hard for us to even to give up the things in our poky little room, let alone the power of a prince. Contrast this with great Atisha, who gave up his royal position, treating it like spittle left in the dust, and who for 7 years depended mainly on Avadhutipa. He also studied the Vajrayana under many other gurus who too were endowed with psychic powers. He became a scholar in all the classic and in every instructions. A place Adishya once traveled to Indonesia, probably somewhere in Jawa. This is what the text is talking about right now. He became a scholar in all the classics and every instruction. Once the thought came to him, I am well versed in the secret tantras, but he lost his pride when some dakinis showed him in a dream many volumes on tantra he had never seen before. When he thought, I shall gain the supreme psychic powers of the Mahamudra in this lifetime by engaging in tantric behavior, that is, taking on a consort, Guru Rahula Gupta came to him by miraculously passing through a wall. What, said the Guru, where are you going? Forgetting sentient beings? Get ordained. Get ordained. It will benefit the teachings and many sentient beings. Then Sri Kheruka appeared in space before Adishya and made a similar appeal. Our teacher Shakyamuni, the master of sages, the Lord Maitreya, also in Adishya's dream asked him to get ordained. He took his full ordination from Shila Raksha and out of the Mahasanghika subsect. Shila Raksha, an abbot of the Mahasangika subsect, who has achieved the patient's stage of the path of preparation. Atisha was ordained at the age of 29. Atisha depended on 157 gurus. He studied all the sciences, sutras, tantras, along with their oral instructions. He made a particular study of all the key points of the four divisions of transmissions of Vinaya under Guru Dharma Rakshita, as well as a huge text that covers in some 800 cantos, the seven divisions of the Abhidharma, metaphysics, called the Great Discussion of the Particular Chetashirishama, which is called Chetashirishama in Tibetan, which His Holiness was talking about just a while ago. He listened to this teaching for 12 years and studied thoroughly because he knew all the subtleties and unconfused differences of the practice of the Eden sub-schools of the Way Bhashik school on such topics as taking alms or what water is fit to drink. He became the crowning jewel of all 18 of these Indian sub-schools. But although he received and practiced all the Dharma on Sutra and Tantra to be found in India at that time, he continued to wonder which path was the swiftest to enlightenment. Rahula Gupta, who was living in a cave on Mount Krishnagiri, knew this through his clairvoyance. He went to Atisha and said, What good is it merely to have the visions of tutelary deities, to manifest many sects of deities in their mandalas, to achieve many of the common psychic powers, or to have single-potent concentration as firm as a mountain chain? Train your mind with love and bodhicitta. Thousand-Nama Avalokiteshvara is the deity of compassion. Take him as your tutelary deity and pledge yourself to work for the sake of sentient beings. Still samsara is emptied. One day, Adishya was walking around the Vajra seat of enlightenment at Bodh Gaya. While on the circumambulation path, it seemed he witnessed a conversation between two statues. Another time, two girls who had transcended the human body were having, it seemed, a conversation in the southern sky over Bodh Gaya. In what dharma should someone who desires swift and complete enlightenment train, asked one girl. The other replied, train in bodhicitta. Then one told the other of a noble method for training in that mind. He stopped circumambulating in order to listen and took to heart, like one vessel receiving all the contents of another. One time he was standing by this stone fence that Acharya Nagarjuna had built. There was an old woman and a girl. Anyone who desires complete enlightenment quickly, said the woman to the girl, should train in bodhicitta. The Vinaya tradition that is there in our Tibetan tradition is Mul Sarvastivadin tradition, whereas Adisha belongs to the Pelten Depa, is another tradition. And when he came to Tibet, he considered introducing his own Vinaya lineage in Tibet at one point. But then his disciple, Upasika Domtempa, informed Choje that he should not do that because this Mulsarvastivadin tradition was introduced in Tibet by Shantarakshita after discussion with the king, Tisson Dezin. So that has become a standard tradition in Tibet, and he should not introduce a new tradition. So in reply, Adisha said, now I don't even have power to give my Vinaya lineage to my disciples in Tibet. In Vinaya tradition, there's no mention about masters wearing hats. But here, in this autobiography about Atisha, here it says that Atisha wore a hat to subdue his arrogance. So what about His Holiness seeing the Tibetans wearing this pointed hat, the monks? You know, is that to show Tibetans how the Lama is very arrogant? His Holiness is just playing, they're asking some of the Geshe's Lamas in the front. Then one told the other of a noble method for. So His Honor says here the in this these in these lines there's a lot of formality. Then one told the other of a noble method for training in that mind. He stopped circumambulating in order to listen and took to okay, this I finished. A statue of the Buddha under a balcony of the great temple at Bodh Gaya once spoke to Adisha while he was circumambulating. Oh, mendicant, it said, if you wish to achieve complete and perfect enlightenment soon, train yourself with love, compassion, Bodhisattva. Once while he made a circuit around a small stone walled cell in an ivory statue, Buddha Shakyamuni said to him, oh, yogi, train in Bodhisattva if you want a true and complete enlightenment soon. Thus Adisha developed more bodhicitta than he had ever done before, and in order to fully increase and develop the bodhicitta he already possessed, he wondered, who holds a complete set of instruction on this? He had made inquiries and discovered that the great Suvarna Dipa Guru was famous for being a master bodhicitta. Adisha made plans to go to Suvarna Dipa in Indonesia in order to receive the complete instruction on bodhicitta at the feet of the great Suvarna Dipa Guru. He traveled the ocean for 13 months in a boat with some traders who were going there on business and knew the way. Kamadeva, the powerful demon god of lust, could not bear to see the Buddha's teaching spread and to hinder Adisha's bodhicitta, made the boat turn around by blowing up a headwind. Then he blocked the boat's passage with an enormous sea monster the size of a mountain, hurled lightning bolts from the sky and so on. This caused much havoc. And Pandit Siddhigarbha fervently implored Adisha to use his wrathful powers. Adisha entered into the samadhi of Red Yamantaka and subdued the demon hordes. And gradually his body made its way to Indonesia. Adisha had already become a great scholar in depth. As we have said, when only 18 months old, he had without any prompting spoken words that proved he was already conversant with bodhicitta, and yet he willingly underwent these hardships to reach Indonesia, which must convince us that nothing is more fundamental in the Mahayana than precious bodhicitta. Adisha spent 13 months on this journey, and he never took off his robes, the sign of ordination. He did not travel as we do, changing clothes outside of the monastery. When monks nowadays go on pilgrimage, supposedly for the sake of benefit of the teaching, they put on only lay clothes. Since the 10th century, Tibet split up into splinter states. But in the 7th, 8th, 9th, some American historians, by researching on Chinese sources, are saying that for about three centuries, in Asia, there were three emperors: Chinese emperor, Tibetan emperor, and Mongolian emperor. The Chinese emperor emphasized on political power, and the Mongolian emperor emphasized, or rather sort of specialized in military power, and Tibetan emperor focused on religious power. You know, I went to China in the 1954, China I went to, and 55 I came back to Tibet. And at Shikang, on the way at Shikang, Tarzido, there was a major earthquake, and I stayed there for some time, for a few days. One night, And also, on the way, I stopped by at Xi'an, which was the ancient Chinese capital. The Buddha statue, which is now in Lhasa, which originally came from China, actually came from that city, Xi'an, because the Chinese capital was there at that time. And the Chinese, Wen Qin Guangzhou, the Chinese princess, brought it to Tibet from there. So the Chinese took us for sort of sightseeing around the city. One Chinese official, known as Fu Sitang, took us sort of, he was one of the deputy leaders in the in that Chinese state, and he told us at that time that during the Chinese Tibetan Empire period, Tibetan forces reached up to this city, and at that time the Chinese emperor had to run away, had to flee the city, and from Xi'an. And one Korean Korean king, also, according to one saying, faced some difficulty, and then the Tibetan emperor sent forces to help him. So what this shows is at that time, the Tibetan empire was very powerful. But during the time of Adisha, Tibet had already split it up into fragments. And Dzogchenpa, Adisha's disciple at that time, sort of mentions about a population count of Tibet at that time. Tibetan's population at that time is said to be about 10 million. But now, so since then, the Tibetan population declined. And recently I met one person, probably a Chinese man. He said that in central Tibet, there's a lot of practice of polygamy. Maybe for the sake, financial reasons, like two or three brothers marrying to one wife. This greatly harmed Tibetan population. That's what this guy said. And one German artist told me also, he went to Israel, and one woman had 9 children. So he told me that you Tibetans also should bear more children. Around the 10th century, Tibetan population said to be about 10 million. Which means that before that, during the empire period, Tibetan population was much greater. So since the Langtama period, Tibet split it up, and there was no central power, and Tibet became fragments. And the Kham and Amdo sort of fragmented away. So a small Tibetan dynasty central power continued to survive, but in a very, very weak way. So as far as Gomrim Parpa, the Gomrim was composed by Kamalashila, who is a disciple of Shantarakshita, requested by Trizong Desi, a great powerful king, whereas Lamrim was Adisha was requested Lamrim was composed by Adisha at the request of Ngari, king of Ngari, a very small king, but who was a descendant of the Tibetan Empire, Tibetan Emperor. So this is what these texts are saying. I think His Holiness is right now on this title. The title is The Things He Did to Further the Doctrine After Gaining These Qualities. How he did this in India and how he did this in Tibet. Right now, it's how did this in Tibet, how he did this in Tibet. His Holiness said that His Holiness is just saying, telling a joke. One Lama, I think Shota Yuketu, asked one monk, what do you know about Dharma? The monk said, I don't know anything, I just attained liberation. So that's kind of a funny statement, because if you have attained liberation, it's very high. But that monk, what that monk is, he had just become monk. He renounced household life. And that is what he meant when he said he just attained liberation. So I'll read out this this section on how he did this in Tibet. The teachings first promulgated in Tibet had, by this time, died out. The later dissemination of the teachings gradually gaining momentum, but some people concentrated on the Vinaya and disregarded the Tantra. Others did just the opposite. Sutra in Tantra had become as opposite as hot and cold. Many well-known pundits came to Tibet from India, lured by the prospect of gold. They deceived the people of Tibet with many evil mantras and tantric sects. And it had become most difficult for the pure teachings of the victorious one to spread. The Tibetan king Lhasa Lama Yishuhu was not happy about this. And in order to promulgate pure teaching, he sent 21 bright Tibetan students to India to bring back pundits who would be more beneficial to Tibet. But all but 20 of them, two of them died. The senior translator Rinchen Tsangpo and the junior translator Legden Sherab both became steeped in Dharma, but still were unable to bring Atisha back with them. When they returned to Tibet, they had an audience with the king on how to harmonize the Sutra and Tantra with the practices and beliefs of the Indian scholars, of all the Indian scholars. There is no other pundit who can benefit Tibet, they said. In Vikramala Shila, there lives a monk who left behind royal birth for monastic life. His name is Dibhamkara Shirijana. If you invite him, it is certain to benefit Tibet. They said that all the other pundits agreed on this. Their speech settled the king's doubts, but more importantly, he developed strong and unconquerable faith in Adishas merely through hearing his name. He sent Gyatsun Singh, together with eight others to bring Adisha back. They took with them much gold but failed. The Dharma king himself went in search of more gold to help bring the pundit back. The Khan of Karlo knew that the king was acting to further the doctrine, so he captured Yishuhu and threatened him with death if he did not abandon his teaching. The king was thrown into prison. His paternal nephew, Changchukhu, went there in an attempt to free his uncle, only to be told by the Khan of Karlo, you can either abandon your plan to bring the pundit and become my vassals, or you can bring me the king's weight in gold. Either way, I shall set him free. Changchukhu promised to hand over the gold. He offered the Khan the 200 ounces in gold he had with him, but the Khan would have none of it. Eventually, he brought the Khan the way to the king's body in gold, but minus the head. The Galo Khan was not interested. I want head and all, he said. Changju did not have the means for any more gold. Instead, he went to the gate of Yishihu's prison. Uncle, he cried, you have been most kind. You are a victim of great. You are a victim of your past actions. If I wage war against this man to defeat him, very many warlike people will perish, and I fear they will be reborn in the lower realms. I was told by this fellow not to invite the pundit, but instead become his vessel. But if we abandon the Dharma, we'll have given in to the sinful king. I think it is better for you to remain true to the Dharma. He told me he wanted your weight in gold. I have been searching for gold, but have only found enough to equal your body without the head. This did not satisfy me, and now I shall go to find the rest. I shall return with the ransom. Until then, you must take thing on your past karma. Petition the three jewels, and above all, take courage and create merit. His uncle laughed and said, I thought you were just a spoiled child who gorged on rich food, unable to brave any difficulties or display any courage. Now I feel you can uphold the tradition of our forefathers when I die. You have acted well. This makes me content. I thought it would be wrong for me to die without having established the foremost rule of Dharma in Tibet. I'm old, and if I were not to die now, I would live only another 10 years. If I give away so much gold just for that, it would shame the three jewels. In my past lives, in beginning this samsara, I have not once died for the Dharma. Do not then give this Khan so much as a speck of gold. How excellent for me to die for the Dharma. If it was such a mighty task to find a gold for just me, where could we find gold for my head? Take all the gold to India. Do all you can to bring Adisha to Tibet, to back. If he will see you, give him my message. I gave up my life to the Karlok King for the Buddha's teaching. And you, Buddha's teaching and your own. Look after me with your compassion for the rest of my lives. My foremost thought was for you to come to Tibet. I did this so that the Buddha's teaching could spread in Tibet. It's His Honest referring to a statement by Vasubandhu. His Honest says this verse should be, you know, sort of put up on, written, inscribed on walls, you know, like placards around the buildings. I did this so you therefore should do only as I ask. Best me so that we definitely meet in my future lives. Nephew, forget about me. Think of the Buddha's teaching. The uncle was in a weak state and the sound of his voice was most piteous. Yet Changju He could well believe that his uncle had the courage to think only about the saint kings of Tibet and of the Buddha's teachings and of Atisha. He forced himself to leave his uncle, Pandit Changju, leave his uncle. Prince Changju He's courage greatly increased and he acted to fulfill his uncle's wishes completely. In Tibet, there were many people passing of numerous crude religions as Tantra. Some of these were the Red Acharya, the infamous Blue Skirt Pandit, and the 18 mendicants of Artso. In order to defeat these people skillfully, King Changju He prayed to the three jewels for guidance as to which of his subjects would be the right person to bring Adisha. All the dice divinations and astrological calculations suggest Nakso, the translator. Nakso happened to be living in the gilded temple at Kongtan. The king summoned him to Ngari, but feared the translator would not promise to go to India. King Changju therefore had Nakso sit on his very own royal throne to show his respect and praise his scholarship, ethics, and kind-heartedness. You must plead with Adisha, said the king. Tell him my forefathers and the past kings and ministers of state and established the Buddha's teaching here. It became the custom, flourished and spread. Now the Buddha's teachings are in a sorry state. A race of demons has taken over. All the scholars have passed away. Both I and my uncle are most saddened by this and have sent much gold and many men to India. But after such a great expenditure, both wealth and men, we still have not brought Adisha back. Our king could not bear this and went in search of gold. and an evil Khan imprisoned him. His Majesty gave his life. When we ignorant sentient beings of the remote land of Tibet have shown such courage, how could you be considered compassionate and an object of refuge for sentient beings? I have 1,400 ounces of gold. Take them and place them in this guru's hands. Tell him, our Tibet is like the city of hungry gurus. Finding gold in our country is like looking for a single louse on a sheep. It is so hard to find. The gold you see here is the entire wealth of people of Tibet. But if you, O protector, do not go to Tibet, it will show how little compassion you holy beings have. We would then never do anything to better ourselves. Not so. You uphold the Vinaya. Tell Atisha our story in person. If he still refuses to explain the situation until he completely understands it. The king was crying so much that there were tears on his lap and on the table in front of him. Lakso, the translator, whose real name was Sujim Gyawa, had not done much traveling before and was not at all keen to go off to distant places. But he could not bring himself to say yes or no. We have a proverb. The one who sees a person crying will begin to cry himself. He knew full well that what the king was saying was quite true. Although he had never met Yeshiva before, he was aware that the uncle and his nephew had spent much in wealth and men, and the two of them had suffered greatly for the sake of Tibet, so that we could be happy. The power of the words of the king, a man of high rank, had deeply moved Nakso. He was speechless, his body was shaking, and his face was covered with tears. He was unable to look at the king's face. The king was asking, His Holiness is saying, Dzomtepa was born at a place called Tsagyema. The king was asking him to risk both life and limb, but Nakso was not attached to any of this life's happiness, and so he said he would go. The king's seven ministers carried the 1,400 ounces of gold as they saw him off on the road to India. The king accompanied him for a great distance. Monk, you are doing this on my behalf, said the king. You are risking life and limb, and with great perseverance are now traveling to places that will create much hardship for you. When you return, I will repay your kindness. The king went back a little way. Then he said, petition the great compassionate one, Avalokiteshvara, while you are journeying. When Naksu, the translator, and his pretty party reached the kingdom of Nepal, they met a tall man who said, I think you are going to a faraway place on a great mission. You will succeed in your mission if you repeat this while you travel. Homage to three jewels. May the holy Dharma, the source of the Buddhas of the three times, spread to the land of snow. So this was, say this as you go, then there will be no misfortune. They asked him who he was. Eventually you will come to know who I am, he said. There were also many other emanations of Dzomtepa, soon to be Atisha's chief disciple. So this tall man, His Holiness was saying, this tall man who appeared on the way was an emanation of Dzomtepa, who would later on become Atisha's disciple. These removed the many dangers that threatened Nakso and his party on the route. At last they arrived at the gate of Vikramala Shila. There was a parapet over the gate, and Gyatsun Singh, because he could understand Tibetan, called down to them from a cleft in the parapet. Tibetan sirs, where have you come from? We have come from Upper Ngari, they answered. There's a young boy, our gatekeeper. Leave all your things with him. Have a good night's sleep in some shelter. The gate will be open just after first light. They gave their gold to the youthful gatekeeper, who put it in an inner room. Trust me as you would your best friend, he said. Don't worry, sleep well. They thought that a small child saying such things could not be an ordinary person. This set their minds at rest. Next morning, as the gate was opened, a young child appeared. He wore a pointed head and was dressed like a Tibetan, complete with two layers of woolen clothes and carrying a small wooden ball. Where have you Tibetans come from? The child asked. You seem to be none the worse for your journey. Naxos party found it heartening to run into someone so fluently speaking the Namit dialect. We have come from the upper Nari, they said. We have had a smooth journey. What brings you here? Where are you going? I am also Tibetan, replied the child. We are going to Tibet. We Tibetans have very loose tongues. We are too naive. We don't know how to keep a secret. Important things must be done in secret. Gyatso Singh is saying, staying in the Tibetan quarters. Ask around and you will find it. And with that, he was gone in an instant. They entered a long, narrow lane, followed it, and came upon an old holy man with a bamboo walking stick. Where have you come from? He asked. What was so important to make you come? We have come from Upper Ngari, they replied. We have come to bring back the illustrious Atisha. Where is Gyatso Singh's house? The old holy man leaned on his stick and rolled his eyes. The child you met this morning spoke the truth. Tibetans can't keep their mouths shut. Even a Tibetan mute would tell all their deepest secrets to people lurking in valleys. How can you possibly hope to accomplish anything this way? It's a good thing you told me, but speak of this to no one but Adisha. I will show you Gyatso Singh's door. The old man made his way slowly, and yet Naxo could not keep up with him. Naxo found him waiting on the threshold of the Tibetan quarters. Great matters must be done slowly, said the old man. Make haste slowly. What you want lies far away, and you must climb a mountain step by step. This is his house. Naxo went inside and made an offering of gold to Gyatso Singh, the translator. Gyatso Singh saw him and asked, where have you come from? He told his story in detail. It appears that you were once my disciple, Gyatso Singh said. And yet I do not recognize you. Tell no one you have come to invite Atisha. Say you have come to learn. There is an elder called Ratnakarashanti. He is very powerful here and is Atisha's master. He must not suspect you have what you intend to do. We shall now make him an offering of an ounce of gold. Tell him we have come from Tibet. We have failed to invite any princes. I have now come to study and ask you to assign us to a pandit. That is how to present your request. After that, be in a hurry and don't let things worry you. Just relax. When the time is right, we shall skillfully invite Adisha to Tibet. Naxo and Gyatso Singh went to see the elder, Ratnakarashanti, and presented him with the ounce of gold. Naxo spoke with him for some time, giving the agreed-on story. The elder then said, that is wonderful. The other pandits cannot subdue sentient beings. This is no exaggeration. The Buddha's teaching may have originated in India, but without Adish, the merit of sentient beings here will decline. He also said many other things. For some time, it was very difficult for them to see Adish. Just the same emanation Avalokiteshvara had provided. Just the same emanation of Avalokiteshvara had provided many auspicious opportunities for Adish to travel to Tibet. Then a day came when there were no other Indian pandits or kings around us to suspect what was happening. Gyatso Singh told Naxo to come and took him to Adisha's room. They offered Adisha a walled mandala, 1 cubit high, surmounted by a gold piece, which was itself surrounded by small pieces of gold. Translator Gyatso Singh spoke for both of them. He told how the king of Tibet was a bodhisattva and how the Dharma had spread under the three Dharma Rajas, Songtsen Gampo, Tisong Devzi, and Tri Rebaje. He told how the King Langtharma had persecuted the teachings and how the great Lama Gompar Rapsi had managed to preserve the Sangha and increase its numbers. He spoke of the sacrifice of the king's uncle had made to bring Adisha to Tibet. He gave Changju his message and described the sort of perverted Dharma prevalent in Tibet. The Bodhisattva King of Tibet, Gyatso Singh said, has sent this monk to invite you, O protector. Don't just talk of going next year. Look compassionately on Tibet. The Tibetan king is a Bodhisattva, said Adisha. The three Dharma Rajas were the emanations of Bodhisattvas. Gongbo Rapsi was an emanation of a Bodhisattva. Otherwise, how could he have rekindled the embers of the teaching? The kings of Tibet are Bodhisattvas. It would be it would not be right to disobey the orders of a bodhisattva. I feel ashamed before this king. He has spent much wealth and many men, youth parents, are in a piteous state, but I am responsible for the many keys of the temple and monastery, I am now old. I have many offices to perform. I cannot hope to return from Tibet. Still, I shall investigate this matter. Keep your gold for the time being. Then he sent them away. Adisha then investigated whether it would benefit the Buddha's teaching if he, out of love for his potential Tibetan disciples, he went to Tibet. He also checked whether it would be a hindrance to his own lifespan. Avalokiteshvara, Aryatara, and so forth told him that it would prove most beneficial to sentient beings and the teachings if he went. Moreover, there would be much benefit resulting from a lay vow holder, upasaka. But if he did go, his life would be shortened. Adisha asked by how much. They told him he would live only to 92 if he did not go. He would live to 92 if he did not go, and if he did go, he would not reach 73, meaning that his life would be shortened by almost 20 years. At this point, His Honor said, Adisha's nature is such that he has a very soft, tender heart. For a small thing, he would feel very tender and very moved. But if he did go, his life. Adisha asked, at this point, Adisha thought of all the benefits of going to Tibet, and if it means a shorter life, then so be it. He had developed such strength of purpose that he did not care for his own life at all. However, Adisha did not want to go to Tibet immediately because the Indian Sangha and their benefactors would say that India, the very fountainhead of the teachings, would go into decline. In order to prevent such talk, Adisha employed his skillful means. Instead of telling people he was going to Tibet, he said he was to go on an extensive tour to make offerings at Bodh Gaya and other great places of pilgrimage, traveling back and forth. Dhammadhamma, being in the true sense a Dhammaraja, skillfully manifested in the forms of traders, and without anyone suspecting it, they took back to Tibet many holy statues of Manjuvara, a form of Guhyasamaj, etc. The symbols of the bodies of the Buddha, as well as many scriptures, the symbols of the Enlightened One's speech. Adisha asked the elder Ratnakara Shanti, if he would be permitted to go to Nepal and Tibet. There were many exceptional stupas and places of pilgrimage there, and he would be gone only as long as it would be take to see them. The elder observed that Adisha seemed rather keen to go and that the Tibetans had been most determined to take him, so he allowed him to go for a short while. Nalso, the translator, had to promise to bring him back within 3 years. Then Adisha and his disciples left India for the kingdom of Nepal. The Tibetan king came with about 300 horsemen and gave a lavish welcome. We were told how the local people would instantly develop faith at the mere sight of him, and how their mind streams became subdued. The next section is, the title is Pabonga Dorje Chang also spoke in detail on the meeting between Adisha and the great translator Rinchen Sangpo. King Changju He made this supplication to Adisha, telling how in the past the three Dhammarajas had endured hundreds of difficulties to establish the Buddhist teachings here in the northern land of snows, but Lang Dharma had persecuted the teachings. Changju He's own forebears, the Dhammarajas of Ngari, had re-established the Buddhist teaching in Tibet without regard for their own lives, but now some people had taken to the Tantras and ignored the Vinaya. Others swore by the Vinaya and ignored the Tantras. The Sutras and the Tantras were held to be as opposite as hot and cold. People carried out their own fanciful practices, and more to the point, Acharya red skirt and Acharya blue skirt taught doctrines of liberation through intercourse to the matted haired and top knotted practitioners of the old tantras. The teachings had declined so much that they were like meaningless babble. He went on in much detail, and his eyes filled with tears. "Compassionate Adisha," he said, "for now do not teach the profoundest and the most amazing of the dhammas of the law of cause. For now, do not teach the profoundest and most amazing of dhammas to your uncivilized disciples of Tibet. I ask you to teach instead the dhamma of the law of cause and effect. Also, may it please the protector and to compassionately teach some error-free yet easy-to-practice dhamma, one that you would yourself practice, one that includes the whole path, would be beneficial to Tibetans in general and encompass the intent of the victorious one's scriptures, the sutras, the tantras, and the commentaries. Further, must one have the praktimoksha vows in order to be a candidate for the vows in the involvement form of bodhicitta? Can one be enlightened without the accommodations of method and wisdom? Is one permitted to teach tantra to one who has not obtained the initiation? Is one permitted to confer the actual wisdom initiation, where one gives the disciples a real consort to vow, celebrates? Is one permitted to perform the practice of secret tantra with tantric path without having already obtained the Vajra Master initiation? These were but some of the questions he asked. Adisha was highly pleased by this and so composed the Lamb of the Path to Enlightenment. In only three folios, this elucidates all the thinkings of the sutras and tantras. It begins. Most respectful homage to all the holy victors of the three times, to their dhammas, to the sangha. Requested by my noble disciple Changzhuhe, I shall light the lamb on the path to enlightenment. Adisha did not say my noble disciple Changzhuhe, because he had received... many offerings from him. Rather, it was because he was delighted with the way Changzhuhe art had asked about Dharma. My own precious guru told me Adisha would not have been at all pleased if he had asked, please give me a major empowerment or a minor initiation. The Lamb on the Path includes the answer to Changzhuhe's question. Soon after its appearance, the crude and perverse teachings in Tibet disappeared from whence they came. Adisha furthered the doctrine in the Abhangari area. But when the 3 years were nearly over, and because of his promise to the elder, Nakso, the translator, said, we must now return to India. Adisha appeared to consent, and so they went to Purang. But previously, Tara had told Adisha repeatedly, it would be most beneficial for the teachers if you took on a great upasaka in Tibet. Now, she was repeatedly telling him, the upasaka will soon be here. So Adisha was constantly on the lookout for him. My upasaka hasn't come, he said. How could Tara lie? One day, Domdomba turned up, while Adisha was visiting a benefactor. Dom went to Adisha's room and was told that Adisha had gone to see his sponsor, but would now be on his way back. I can't wait one moment, said Dom Rinpoche. The sooner I meet my Mahayana spiritual guide, the better. I'm going to where he is. He left and met Adisha in an alley. Dom made full-length prostration and went up to Adisha, who put his head on Dom. Who put his hand on Dom's head while saying many auspicious things in Sanskrit. Adisha, while with his sponsor, has said, I need a portion of food for my upasaka. He was carrying food with him. Adisha was a strict vegetarian, and the meal he had been given that day consisted of barley dough steeped in ghee. Dom ate the barley dough but saved the clarified butter, making a large butter lamb big enough to burn all night. He placed it by Adisha's pillow, and he is said to have placed similar butter lamps by his teacher's pillow every day without fail for the rest of Adisha's life. That night, Adisha gave Dharma Rinpoche a major initiation and adopted him as his spiritual son. They set out from Purang and went to Kirong in the Mangye district, planning to pass through Nepal en route to India. But the way was blocked because a war had broken out. they could not go any further. At this point, Dom urged Adisha to go back to Tibet, while Naksu pleaded with him to travel on to India. The translator was frustrated because he could not travel back to India. Adisha said to him, "You should not worry so much. You have not done anything wrong, for you are unable to carry out your promise." This made the translator very happy. "Very well," he said, "let us return to Tibet." So Adisha decided to return to Tibet. The teaching approach of Lamrim and the three principles are slightly different. Lamzu is in the Lamzu three principles. First, feeling averse to this world's pleasure, and then comes next life's pleasures. Whereas in the Lamrim, it's the other way around, or something like that. So Adisha decided to return to Tibet. He could not go on to India because the road was blocked at this time. Because Adisha could not proceed, they sent a message to India saying Adisha has traveled back to Nepal because of the fighting on the way, so he could not return as the elder had ordered. This means that we have to return to Tibet for a while. Could you invite Adisha back when the travel dies down? Because it would be most helpful for sentient beings. Could you allow Adisha to remain in Tibet while he's there? He will write more treatises like the one enclosed. They sent Adisha's autographed copy of The Lamb on the Path along with much gold. His Honor says, Lakdon Chemo is an outstanding piece of work by Tsongkhapa. His Honor said he will stop here for today. So just like ancient Tibetan kings and ancient Tibetan masters have worked hard, so we should repay their kindness and don't disgrace them and disgrace ourselves. Zonis and the monk Sangha is reciting the Lamrim prayer by Tsongkhapa.
Oh. Jumbe, Tata, Jimmy, Yodo, Jibbe, Nada, Dumbo, Yeah.